Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our telephone talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us this morning. In the first hour of the program today, we will be exploring some of the history of the University of Illinois and talk about how it came to be founded, some of the challenges faced by the early administrators, and how it is that the university took shape and came to be what we would recognize as a modern university. And our guest for the program is Wynton Solberg. He's an emeritus professor of history at University of Illinois. He's written two books exploring this territory. The first, which was published in 1968, and we must say with some sadness is no longer in print, is The University of Illinois, 1867 to 1894, An Intellectual and Cultural History. Now, this book covers the first 27 years of the history of university. It was published by the University of Illinois Press. Just recently, the press has brought out a second volume covering the years between 1894 and 1904, called U of I, University of Illinois, The Shaping of the University. So if you're interested in exploring some of this history, and it is quite interesting, you might seek out these books. And of course, as we talk, you should feel free to be a part of the conversation. Maybe you have some questions you'd like to ask. It's easy to do that. Just dial the number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll free, 800-222-9455. At any point here, you can join the conversation. All we ask of callers is that people just try to be brief, and we ask that so that we can keep the program moving along, accommodate as many different folks as possible. But anyone is welcome to call. Well, thanks for being here.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
To talk a little bit about why the establishment of the university and other universities that were set up at about the same time, why that's important, probably we could start by talking a little bit about what colleges were like in the United States before that, say in the period before the Civil War. They were really different. And that's why the land-grant college represented such an important development. What were colleges like? What was higher education like in the United States before that?
Well, the so-called old-time college, that is the colleges in that period before the universities developed, were small in a student body. They were almost entirely male students. Very few women attended colleges until the latter part of this period. Almost all of these colleges were church-related under the sponsorship of religious denominations, and they emphasized a rather narrow program, a fixed curriculum in which all the students studied the same subjects, with the idea of developing the so-called faculties. The analogy was that if you learned to develop your muscles, you would be able to carry a load later in life. And therefore, if you developed your mind, you could apply your mind to almost any field you entered later on in life. So you had a narrow curriculum that emphasized math and classical languages and literature because that furnished the taste. And many people felt by the 1840s that these colleges were a product of an English upper-class education and were largely unrelated to the necessities of a democratic, westward-moving popular culture. So a great reform movement set in about the 1840s to supersede or to reform the old-time college.
So these people, they were studying Latin and Greek, they were reading the classics, they did study mathematics, but would not have studied much in the way of science?
They got some science, but yes, no, they did get some physics. They would have gotten some natural science. Not a lot, though. It was primarily oriented toward the classical tradition. And, of course, the colleges were designed to produce Christian gentlemen. Usually in the last year, in the senior year, the president of the college, who normally was an ordained Protestant minister, would teach a course in Christian evidences to make sure that the people who, when they graduated, were good members of Christian churches.
At about the time or shortly before the time this university was established, then people started to think about what the country needed.
That's right.
And felt that that kind of education didn't didn't provide for the needs of this growing country and thought that there ought to be something different, that higher education ought to be open to everyone, or at least it ought to be more open than it was, and that it ought to provide some practical skills so that people who are going to be farmers or work in factories or inventors or people who would be working with their hands would be skilled and taught as well.
That's right. You would democratize education by not just taking the sons of upper-class people, doctors, lawyers, ministers, and so forth, but of workers. And rather than forcing them to learn how to build buildings or to construct canals or whatever by the apprenticeship method, you would teach them in organized courses and open these colleges to producing people who could build the nation, build the infrastructure, and you would also open the colleges to women. Mm. It was a very democratizing movement for a democratic country.
And here, so we come to the idea of the land grant institution.
That brings us to the land grant. Therefore, and then as the reform movement swelled up, that is not only to reform the old-time college, but to totally reconstruct it by bringing the federal government in to provide an economic basis for the states to develop their own higher educational institutions. And this then culminated in the Morrill Land Grant Act of 1862, by which the federal government gave land or the paper that entitled the states to go out and find land in western states with the proceeds of which they could then develop their own colleges or universities.
Mm-hmm. One result, I think, as you point out in the first book, that that's still in place today is that this established a relationship between universities and the federal government. Was this something that at the time was it all controversial?
Oh, it was very controversial. As a matter of fact, there had been an attempt to pass a law along the lines of a land grant act that was vetoed by President Buchanan because it was felt that this was not something that the federal government should get involved with. And when Lincoln came into office then, Lincoln was willing to sign the act. It was during the Civil War. And therefore, the land-grant colleges were supposed to produce people for the military establishment also, the compulsory military training programs, miniature West Points, if you like, mm-hmm. which is what this university was in the early days.
Mm-hmm. Was here in the state of Illinois, was there popular support or how much support was there for the idea of a state university of this kind?
Well, that's a very interesting question because there was some support for it here, but it, Jonathan Baldwin Turner, who came from Yale, he had been educated in an old-time college, but he saw the need for vast educational reform. He was kind of the spark plug of a movement, but to reform the old-time college and to bring about the land-grant universities. But in the state of Illinois in general, the population had come in. The state had been settled by people who came from the southeastern part of the United States who had no tradition of publicly supported schools. And they felt that our young people don't really need higher education, formal education. They were very reluctant to spend money for schools. Illinois has in that sense, here's this powerful, economically rich state that was not very willing to put up money for schools. Illinois is very late in doing that.
Mm-hmm. Perhaps I should, at this point, for anyone who's just tuned in, introduce again our guest. We're talking this morning about the history of the University of Illinois with Wynton Salberg. He is an emeritus professor of history at the University of Illinois. He's written two books exploring the early history of this institution, the first covering the period between 1867 and 1894. This book was published by the University of Illinois Press in 1968 and is no longer in print. However, he has a new book that's just come out more recently that covers the period between 1894 and 1904. This is also published by the U of I Press, and it should be out in bookstores if you'd like to take a look at it. And, of course, questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I guess also that at the time when people were talking about setting up the University of Illinois, there was some perhaps disagreement about what the main focus should be, and particularly whether agriculture should be the main focus or industry, should that be the main focus? That is, should it be an industrial college? Should it be an agricultural college?
No, I think I would modify that somewhat. Under the terms of the Morrill Act, these newly founded colleges were obligated to teach agriculture and the mechanical arts, or mechanic arts, that is to say agriculture and engineering. And you could teach other subjects, not excluding other subjects. What happened here then was that the influence of the old time curriculum, that is Greek, Latin, literature, liberal arts and humanities subjects, had a great pull, and a number of students wanted to study those things, and therefore the state legislature stepped in about 5 years after the university started and mandated that every student would have to study agriculture because they felt the college was not redeeming the pledge to reform higher education. But what became significant then is that though these colleges were designed to train agriculturists, there was no agriculture science available at the time to make the study of agriculture that important. And I think most farmers felt that there's no point in sending my son off to Urbana to learn agriculture because they don't have enough to teach him. So agriculture didn't get started, and this university developed really as a school of engineering. Engineering was the colossus on the campus, to use the title of a chapter in this current book. Most of the students were in engineering. Most of the students were male, and the college developed along those lines to the exclusion of the others until the 1890s, when the Board of Trustees finally said, we must do something to redress the balance and start out in a new direction, create a university, because the University of Illinois was not well considered by the people of the state as of 1894, I think it's fair to say.
Mm-hmm. And at that time, it was called the Illinois Industrial University.
Well, that's right.
Not University of Illinois.
That's right. Well, the change to the new title came in the 1880s. Mm-hmm. Because it was felt that too many people thought this was a reform school or a reformatory of some sort. Well, the name was not fortunate. But it emphasized the notion that we want to train classes or people who can produce this new industrial order. Mm-hmm. Railroads, factories that America's developing, canals, roads.
How is it that the University of Illinois ended up in Urbana and not someplace else?
Oh, that's a sad story. It's a deal. It had to go someplace, and I think I forget all the details. I think a chapter in that early book called The Auction and the Elephant. There was an old school established, I think, by the Methodists where the Beckman Center is now, and there's a building you could use for a university. And Clark Grigsby and others from Illinois went over to Springfield and were very good at lobbying and I think probably bamboozling legislators to choose Urbana, Champaign, which in many ways was not the best location at the time, and that this area was not yet well developed in terms of roads and a transportation system. It didn't have great natural wonders, but ultimately, it's a good place for a university. There are not a lot of distractions that take the faculty and students away from their studies.
Well, indeed, when you read the experiences of the students in those years, it does seem that they were hard-pressed to find other things to do, and because of the way that the curriculum and their studies were scheduled, they probably didn't have a lot of time to do anything else.
No, they worked hard. The program was very demanding. This place was always very serious academically. Of that, I think there's no doubt. And as I read the records of these early years, I'm very impressed with the quality of most faculty members and of the students as a student body in collectively. You know, there's some laggards, of course, but
we have a caller here. Let's talk with them in Champaign County on line number one. Hello.
Good morning. Isn't it possible also that when it was called Illinois Industrial College, was that what it was called? That industry in the 1860s might have been able to include agriculture at the time. That it was more inclusive. From our point of view now, industry is factories, but it may have been that it was more the root of the word, just sort of being industrious and, you know, claiming the prairie sort of thing.
I think that's a fair comment. It was an Illinois Industrial University, not college, but I think industry in the broadest sense, as the Morrill Act itself said, mm-hmm. that these colleges founded with federal support are to train people in agriculture and in the mechanic arts, or what we would today call engineering. Clearly, there was a desire to train people for agriculture.
Mm. You already answered one of my questions, but I'd like for you to elaborate on it. I was wondering about quote-unquote military science and the fact that it, you know, I think until 1965, reserve officer training was mandatory for the first 2 years of any male student. And most, I think it was still mostly male at the time. But you were implying that military science was, I revolt at the formulation, but I guess that's what it was called, was in the curriculum from the beginning?
It was in the curriculum from the beginning. And again, the Morrill Act said that they were to, that these colleges were to have military programs. Now, whether or not you absolutely had to require all students to take military science could be open to question, but the law was interpreted that way by the first Board of Trustees, and there's great emphasis upon having a cadet corps. And the War Department sent out a graduate of West Point to be in charge of the military program. And for all practical purposes, what we have on the campus is a small West Point. There is a band. The beginning of the university band comes with a bugle corps, or a band that is designed to accompany the military unit. And all students had to take the course in military science. It developed through the years and was a very important part of the program. We had one of the largest ROTCs by the early 20th century of any state university in the country.
Yeah. Well, in the 1860s, I guess, there were still Indian wars in the periphery.
Right. Right.
I understand that WPGU, which is an anomaly in itself because it was one of the few commercial college stations, and I don't know if you have anything on that. It's not an anomaly now since a lot of stations have gone commercial in university milieus because of budget cuts, but PGU apparently stands for Parade Ground Unit, and it was, I guess, calling people to march around sort of thing. I don't know if you know
no,
that.
No, I don't know about that. I just draw a blank there.
Okay. I assume that there might have been some arguments around the Morrill Act that it wasn't at the same time that land grants were going to railroad companies and robber barons of that ilk, that they might have made the argument, well, you know, we can deed this land, you know, whether it was covered by the Grouseland Treaty or not, we can deed this land to railroads, so why can't we deed it to a university? Well, particularly because there's a big military component. I'll have to hang up and listen off the air. Thanks.
All right.
Very interesting.
Thanks.
Yes, sir. You're quite right. The federal government did grant great subsidies to the railroads to extend their lines out to the Pacific coast. You remember that the background to all this is the whole question of to what extent the federal government ought to step in and be an active promoter of public welfare. The southern states, wanting to protect slavery, didn't want the federal government to be active in any respect. Therefore, that battle had to be fought. But gradually, the new Republican Party, led by Abraham Lincoln and others coming out of the Whig background, had decided that we should use the federal government to promote public welfare. And education is clearly one area where this ought to be done. And in addition, industry, namely the railroads, which were one of the major industries of that period.
Mm. This business of military science and its place in the early history, I think, is quite interesting, as you point out and you write about in the book. People here in Illinois, there may have been some question about what the Morrill Act intended as far as military training was concerned, but they interpreted it to mean that all students were required to take these courses. So they did. They drilled. And apparently there was even someone who thought that the students should wear their uniforms all day and that professors and students should salute one another.
Yes, I think for a time they did wear the uniforms all day and the salute on the campus, right? Only in the 1930s was there a spirited discussion, controversy over the question of whether the Morrill Act made it compulsory for all students to take military science or whether this was somewhat optional. And President David Kinley at the time was absolutely insistent that the Morrill Act be interpreted as requiring, mandating military science on the part of all male students. Mm.
The university opened in 1867. Women arrived as students in 1870, so it took a couple of years. Was that also something that there was controversy about, whether women should be admitted?
Well, in general, there throughout the country, I don't know there's so much active controversy about it as the fact that women just had not been considered normal candidates for entrance into public or any type of higher education. I don't think there was a great controversy over it here. The university, on the whole, was quite early and forward in admitting women. I don't recall any big fight over that issue. It was just done. But it was somewhat uncommon at the time.
We have another caller. This is someone on a cell phone, line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I just wanted to make a comment and sort of in response to the ROTC issue. I wasn't in ROTC. I'm not necessarily defending it, but I actually think that removing a lot of ROTC programs from normal colleges was, which has happened, especially during the 60s and 70s, is not really a very good thing, because you end up with an officer corps that comes from a very narrow background, whereas if you have a fairly broad-based officer corps, you're going to have people coming in into the military with very different views, or at least more different than you might have otherwise. So I'm not sure that I think the previous caller certainly disparaged the that program to some extent. I'm not sure that's such a wise thing. I don't know if you have any comment on that.
Well, I do have comments on that. They really transcend what we're focusing on here, but let me speak very briefly. I myself am the product of an ROTC program. I entered the University of South Dakota in the fall of 1939, and I had to take ROTC. It was an infantry or an army program. I went on to the advanced program because I saw the war coming and I felt I'd rather be an officer rather than an enlisted man. My complaint about the ROTC program was that it was not awfully well taught. They didn't prepare us very well, I think. I was then an infantry officer in combat during World War II. I came back and for a time I taught at West Point during the Korean War. So I think I have a fairly good idea of what these programs can do and can't do. I think you could make a very good case for both of the arguments that ROTC does belong in universities. It seems to me that it's really better for students to study more academic subjects, and the Army could recruit its officer corps another way. But that's a separate argument on which I'm open to all sorts of discussions, and I don't think it's awfully profitable to try to fight that out here.
Yeah, no, I'm not proposing that. I just think that there's been a view of among a some people to say, hey, let's get this off campus. And I'm not sure that I agree. I don't know enough about the program to know whether the quality issue is a problem or the other things like that. But I just worry about a military that's not broadly based in the society.
It's a very good concern, I think. What you say makes very good sense. In my particular case, for example, ROTC class, the Army had sufficiently poor experience with commissioning officers outright that with my class of 1943, we had to go to officers' candidate school to win our commissions, and about half of my graduating class did not get their commissions in OCS.
Interesting. Thanks very much. It's very interesting to hear the history of the university.
Well, thank you for the call. Our guest this morning in this first hour of Focus 580, Wynton Salberg. He is an emeritus professor of history at University of Illinois and has written two books that detail the early years of the University of Illinois. The first one, University of Illinois, 1867 to 1894, covers the first 27 years. It was published by the University of Illinois Press in 1968. And just recently, a second book looking at the years between 1894 and 1904. That's The University of Illinois, The Shaping of the University. It's published by the University of Illinois Press. And questions are welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Here's someone else to talk with in Terre Haute on our line number four. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I realize this is not covered in the time period of your books, but I wonder if you could talk about the origin of the Institute of Aviation and the Willard Airport, and I'll hang up and listen.
Well, I can certainly say something about Willard Airport. A few years ago, I interviewed Park Livingston, who was then who had been a member of the Board of Trustees at the time the airport was founded here. And Park Livingston and I went to talk with Augie Meyer, who was a banker and director of WCIA, the television station locally. What I learned from those men at that time, and I have some documents on this, but I've not made a full-fledged study of it yet, is that Livingston and Augie Meyer went to then-Senator Scott Lucas, who represented Illinois in the United States Senate, during World War II, and pleaded with Lucas to get an airport for downstate Illinois on the grounds of it being a federal necessity during the war. My own interpretation of this evidence, so far as I can think about the subject now, is that this was a means of central Illinois development, which was sponsored during a war with using the war emergency as a cover to advance economic and proprietary interests. But beyond that, I can't say. Now, the Institute of Aviation then came later, and I can't speak with any in any detail about that. I think the founding of Willard Airport raises a nice question as to whether or not this is a very central purpose for a university to be involved in running an airport. Beyond that, I think I've told you about what I know at this point, and certainly what I've said. The interpretation, the facts and the interpretation that I've offered would be subject to revision in light of studying this question more carefully.
All right. Hope that that at least provides a partial answer. Let's talk with someone else. This is a caller in Kankakee, and it's line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes. Growing up in Kankakee, the word was that back in the late 1800s, Kankakee had the choice between the University of Illinois or the state hospital, and it chose the state hospital. I wonder if you could comment on that and how much truth there is to that matter. Now, I'll hang up. Thank you.
All right.
I think I can't say anything very definitive about that. It seems to me that as I search my memory, I think I've heard about Kankakee bidding. There were a number of cities that wanted to get the university, and there was a kind of a feeling of trade-off, namely, if you get the state hospital for the deaf or the feeble-minded, then somebody else gets the university. The normal log rolling and trading that goes on. But beyond that, I can't be specific. And a lot of these stories, as you indicate, get circulated in the realm of rumor and are not necessarily true, but I can't pin it down definitively.
Right. And other questions, welcome. We're a little bit past the midpoint here, and if you'd like to call us, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Probably I think one of the most important and most interesting characters in the early years of the university was the first president, John Gregory, and certainly someone who set the tone and the future course of the university. And one of the things about him that seemed particularly interesting was that we talked about what a classical education was like before the Civil War and about the fact that people thought that the country had needs that this kind of education wasn't providing, and they were arguing for a different kind of university. Gregory, it seems, wanted to have both and to hold on to some elements of the classical education at the same time provide this new kind of education.
I think you're exactly right, and I agree. I think Gregory is a very admirable man. His full name was John Milton Gregory, and the John Milton tells you something. He came from good Protestant stock. He was an ordained Baptist minister. He had been educated well in an Eastern college, the old-time system. He had been briefly president of a college in Kalamazoo before coming here. The great thing about Gregory, I think, is this willingness to kind of strike a balance between the best of the old while making progress toward taking the best of the new. He had never been to Europe, I think, before he became president of the university. He made a trip to Europe, and you can just see this man grow as his knowledge of the larger world grows in his office. He got the university off to a very good start, I think.
We're talking a little bit earlier about the military training that seemed to be a place where he ran into some difficulties, and in fact, there were probably some other things that were going on, but he resigned, but in point of fact, he apparently was driven out by the students, and one of their chief areas of complaint was the military training.
Well, the military training was always a source of tension in that there were rules, students had to take it, many of them didn't like taking it, they didn't feel they got much out of it, I think. I think it probably would go a little bit far to say Gregory was driven out. Maybe I come close to that in saying there were troubles that made it convenient for him. But he had been here more than 10 years at that time. And his wife had died, and he had been rather foolish in the way he courted his second wife, who taught in the faculty for a time. And I think he lost a bit of prestige or respect as a result of this, being head over heels in love with a younger woman. But with under Peabody, his successor, there was a revolt in the military because Peabody was a very strict, literal-minded man. Who enforced the rules in a rather harsh way, and the students just were fed up with it.
Yeah. Well, perhaps in Gregory's case, it was a combination of things, and at least in part the fact that it had been 10 years. I'm sure it had many difficulties. He probably was tired of it by that point and thought, well, maybe it wouldn't be such a bad thing to hand it over to somebody else.
That's right. I think that's true.
Other callers here. We have someone in Urbana. Line number one. Hello.
Yeah, is this me?
Yes.
Yeah, hi. I've done a lot of research in this area, and I just wanted to say I read Winton's book, too. It's so interesting, and what I find is the original statements of these people. It fits into just exactly what you're talking about, because can I read just two quick quotes and ask a question?
Sure.
When Gregory said, when he talked at the beginning of the university, he said, "The light of high and classical learning will be found as beautiful and becoming when it shines in an educated farmer's home as when it gilds the residence of a graduated lawyer or physician." And then later he went about collecting art for the university and forming the first art museum, which was in the first university library, one of those rooms. And there's a whole story attached to it. But the response wasn't great. Here, he had to raise money elsewhere. But anyway, the student newspaper at that time said, "The age, no doubt, is rapidly approaching when foreigners will no longer cry out against the supremely disgusting taste of Americans," which I thought was a wonderful quotation. And so my question is, can you talk about the beginnings of architecture and art, which is in the humanities, and architecture had a practical use, it had functional use, and could be applied to the philosophy of the early university. Art had to come in through the back door.
Well, yes, I'd be glad to comment on that. It is true, of course, that Gregory started an art gallery, and we had, apart from Chicago, we really have an art gallery before the Art Institute is founded. A very anomalous thing where here in the prairie there is an attempt made to found a significant art institution. Now, there was in the College of Literature and Arts a department called Art and Design. It was originally intended primarily to train people in design for architecture and practical types of things. And the early professors of art keep asking the authorities to put up just a few dollars so that we can bring in some artworks of living painters to show the rural youth of Illinois who come here as students something about the larger world of art. They get no place on this because it raises a really important question. What can we do to teach art? And the answer in the early 20th century is that, well, we really can't develop a school of art here, but what we can do is train a constituency that can understand good art when they see it. And it's not really until well into the late 40s that we get the Festival of Contemporary Arts, which is a very significant development on this campus in focusing art, music, and related creative activities that lasted from 48 until about almost 1970. It's really killed off during the countercultural period.
I think it went to. Yeah. Right. Well, I just mentioned, too, that there's a very good, very fine portrait of Gregory in the library. When you come in on the east side, there's a room, the first room has some of these portraits, and it was done by, I think, the first head of the art department, Ruth.
That could be. There's a good portrait. There are portraits of the several of the early presidents there.
Yeah, it's worth seeing. Most people just sort of rush into the library, but it's worth looking at those portraits. Well, it's an interesting story, and I think, as I said, you know, just at every era, in every era, there was another president who brought a different kind of leadership. And so your book should be really interesting to bring it more up to date. I look forward to reading it.
Thank you for the call. All right, let's go to someone else here. This is Bradley, line number 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I just want to make a comment about the Kankakee either getting the hospital or the college or the university. And that's a rumor. I don't know how it got started, but it's not true. Emory Cobb, who was a very influential and wealthy citizen of Kankakee at the time, I believe was on the board of the university. And if there had been any chance of him having the college located here, it would have been done. But they didn't have a choice, you know. That's the story, anyway.
I think you're correct. Emory Cobb was on the board. He was very influential, and I suspect what you say is absolutely true.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's all I had.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
We do have about 10 minutes left. If you'd like to call in, ask a question, make a comment, the number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, so if it would be a long-distance call for you, you may use that number. That's 800-222-9455. And our guest is Wynton Salberg. He is a professor emeritus of history here at the University of Illinois. I want to give you an opportunity. I know I have concentrated most of the questions on the period covered by the previous book, and I want to at least make sure that we talk a little bit about the current book, because it's the one that's new and it's in print, that deals with a relatively short period of time here. We're only talking about 6 years.
Ten.
Pardon me, 10 years. You can tell that I didn't major in mathematics. and this is a period, this was the period of Andrew Draper, who was president of the university. Perhaps we might talk a little bit about him and about just what's important about this particular 10 years.
Well, it is a short period of time, and it's a fairly substantial book on a short period of time, but there is a unity to this period that makes it sensible, I think, to start and end where I do. And the unity is the thesis of the book, really, the subtitle, The Shaping of the University. Andrew Sloan Draper came here from New York State. He was a politician, really, a conservative Republican politician who had been a superintendent of public instruction in the state of New York. When the political wheel turned, he lost out there. He went out to Cleveland and was superintendent of schools there. He had made a name for himself, and the Board of Trustees is just lusting after a big name to bring some national recognition to the University of Illinois when we've been so neglected for so long. Draper was, I think, a gruff, domineering, autocratic, efficient type of person who had never had a day of college or university experience himself. He had gone 1 year to a proprietary law school and then entered a law practice. And I think it turns out that he was a bad choice. He held back the development of the university in a very substantial way. He had no vision, really, of what a research-oriented university was at a time when Harvard, Yale, Chicago, Michigan, California were developing along these new lines of this reform movement to give America universities that would train people, not just educate the oncoming classes. So the thesis of this current book really is that during these years, the university gained the structure of a university. The university took shape. That is, we get a law school. We get a school of library science. We get a school of music. We get in Chicago a school of medicine, a school of dentistry, a school of pharmacy, but we totally lack the spirit of a university. The structure is there, but we're not able to move forward. And I think we lost a very important ground at that time that's been almost impossible to make up ever since. Because when the American Association of Universities was founded in 1900, this was a group of the leading universities in the United States. I think there were 12 at the time. The University of Illinois is not a member. That group, founded in 1900, was designed to show that American universities are the equivalent of Europe, European universities. You don't have to go to Germany to get a PhD because we can train you as well in this country. We're not admitted to membership in that group because we're not in that caliber yet. But what happens in this period is that the basis is laid. The last part of the book is called Poised for Takeoff. And if you get a president who really understands the name of the game, you can really make progress. And we did. Edmund J. James came as president in 1904. I'm working on that period now. The most exciting period in the history of the university, I think. Well, almost the most exciting. But this is the period in which this university became a leading American university without question. And it shows, I think, that if you get a president who really knows what he wants in terms of a quality university, and now we're back with the prairie, and James said, look, why can't you establish a world-class university on the prairie of East Central Illinois if you work at it? If you're going to do that, you need a first-class faculty with a first-class library. We'll go out and get it. And he did. Hmm. It's an absolutely amazing story.
We have some other callers. We'll try to get them in the time that remains. The next is in Champaign, and this is line one. Hello.
Yes, I was driving in, and I heard the question asked as to when women were allowed to become a part of the student body at the U of I. I think it was within 2 years of its opening, which is amazing. But I would like to know, was the University of Illinois as receptive of allowing African Americans to become a part of this world-class university?
I think in general the university is very receptive to the admission of African Americans. There aren't too many in the early years. On the first board of trustees, there is an African American. He's a man who lives over in Springfield. I think he was a janitor in one of the state buildings. I think he never came to a meeting of the board of trustees. My interpretation of that evidence would be that in the aftermath of the Civil War, slaves have been freed. It was felt desirable to put an African-American on the board, but he probably didn't feel comfortable in associating with his colleagues, and he didn't. The records show that he didn't attend a meeting. There aren't too many black students in the early years, but by the turn of the century, there are, well, in the new book, I list them all. I count them. There are about 13 or 15 or something like that. The university was open to students. That is not to say that they had fair treatment once they got here in terms of what the town did for them or what their fellow students might have felt. But there is a black who was editor of a man named William W. Smith, as I recall, from Broadlands, who was editor of the Illini at in the year 1900 or 1901. There was a black in the football team. There was a black in the band who was noted as a drummer. Clearly, they achieved and gained recognition within the university.
Thank you, sir.
All right, thank you. And to Chicago, line four. Hello.
Yeah, hi. Mm-hmm. My question is basically that of one of, as an observer, and this is impressionistic, and that is that in speaking of, and I think you've already answered the question, but maybe you could get into this further. My impression is that when you speak of land-grant colleges, Illinois doesn't quite come up to the level of Michigan and, I guess, Berkeley. And is that still accurate?
Well, yes, in many ways it is accurate. Michigan is not a land-grant college. Michigan State is, but the University of Michigan at Ann Arbor was founded about 1837. It had a great head start on us, and one of its early presidents was a man named Tappan who had a great vision of what a university should be. he was run out of office because he tried to do things that were a bit ahead of their time. But Michigan has always been, that is the university at Ann Arbor, was founded earlier than we were. And Berkeley is founded almost the same time. But what happens at both Michigan and California that didn't happen here was that there was a unity between the Board of Trustees and a very knowledgeable president that we must proceed cooperatively to make this a great university. We lacked that. Our Board of Trustees, I think, was it's understandable that they tried to get a big name for the university, but Draper was not fit to be a good university president, and they endured the man for 10 years. His deans revolted against him as soon as he left because of his autocratic and repressive and regressive measures. It's that type of thing that other universities, Michigan and California notably, had that we lacked.
Okay, thank you.
All right. I am interested that it seems that from the very beginning there was some argument about whether the mission of the university should be to pass on existing knowledge or to generate new knowledge. And we still seem to be arguing that one.
No, I don't think we argue that anymore, but that is being argued at this point. That is, I think in 1894, when this book starts, so when I start covering the university in this period, the feeling was that the mission of the university is to train the oncoming generation, that is, to teach undergraduates. Mm-hmm. There's very little recognition at official levels of the need to expand new knowledge so that you have some reservoir of knowledge to draw upon to train undergraduates. All of the deans kept appealing to the president and the Board of Trustees to make an official declaration about the purpose, the intention of the university with respect to research. They don't do it. I think that issue has been solved, namely that the now it's felt that the university has an obligation to teach the oncoming generation. Undergraduate instruction is important, and don't ever deny it. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you must advance knowledge, and that is the research function in the graduate college with a faculty that's called upon to publish as well as to be teachers. And James, for example, insists that in hiring people, you must be an effective teacher and give evidence that you're going to be a productive scholar. Otherwise, you have no future at Illinois.
We must stop because we've used the time. There's much more we could be talking about. Perhaps we should say on another day we'll have to talk some more.
Well, it'd be nice. Thank you very much.
For the moment, though, we'll say thanks to our guest, Wynton Salberg. He's Emeritus Professor of History at University of Illinois. And if you'd like to read his most recent book, it's titled The University of Illinois, 1894 to 1904, The Shaping of the University. It is published by University of Illinois Press.